And in the middle of this alien desolation lay his chubby 4-year-old brother in a pair of shorts and a T-shirt reading, "They Call Me Dr. Love." David was clutching at his throat, trying to breathe the no air of a world that was maybe a trillion light years from home. David was gagging, turning purple. Frost was tracing death patterns across his lips and fingernails. But then the merciful panic finally took over. He raked back the sheet he had used to cover David and overturned the crate that had concealed the machine. He stomped the sewing machine pedal again and again and began to scream. It was not until his mother reached him that she realized he was not just screaming. There were actually words in all that noise. "All the G.I. Joes!" Hilly shrieked. "All the G.I. Joes! All the G.I. Joes! Forever and ever, all the G.I. Joes!" And then, infinitely more chilling, "Come back, David! Come back, David! Come back!" "Dear God, what does he mean?" Marie cried. Bryant took his son by the shoulders and turned him around so they were face to face.
"Where's David? Where did he go?"
But Hilly had fainted, and he never really came to. Not long after, over 100 men and women, Bobby and Guard among them, were in the woods across the road beating the bushes for Hilly's brother David. If he could have been asked, Hilly would have told them that, in his opinion, they were looking too close to home. Far too close. Chapter 4. Banton Jingles. 1. On the evening of July 24th, a week after the disappearance of David Brown, Trooper Benton Rhodes was driving a state police cruiser out of Haven around 8 o'clock. Peter Gavins, known to his fellow officers as Jingles, was riding shotgun. Twilight lay in ashes. These were metaphorical ashes, of course, as opposed to the ones on the hands and faces of the two state cops. Those ashes were real. Rhodes's mind kept returning to the severed hand and arm, and to the fact that he had known instantly to whom they had once belonged. "Jesus. Stop thinking about it," he ordered his mind. "Okay," his mind agreed, and went right on thinking about it.
"Try the radio again," he said. "I bet we're getting interference from that damn microwave dish they put up in Troy." "All right."
Jingles grabbed the mic.
"This is Unit 16 to base. Do you copy, Tug? Over."
He let go of the button and they both listened. What they heard was a peculiar screaming static with ghostly voices buried deep inside it.
"Want me to try again?"
Jingles asked.
"No. We'll be clear soon enough."
Bent was running with the flashers on, doing 70 along Route 3 toward Derry. Where the hell were the backup units? There hadn't been a communications problem to and from Haven Village, radio transmissions so clear they were almost eerie. Nor had the radio been the only eerie thing about Haven tonight.
"Right,"
his mind agreed.
"And by the way, you recognized the ring right away, didn't you? No mistaking a trooper's ring, even on a woman's hand, is there? And did you see the way her tendons were hanging down in flaps? Looked like a cut of meat in the butcher shop, didn't it? Leg of lamb or something tore her arm right off. It—"
"Stop it," I said. "God damn it, just quit."
"Okay, yeah, right. Forgot for a sec that you didn't want to think about it. Or like a rolled roast, huh? And all that blood." "Stop it. Please stop it,"
he moaned.
"Right, okay. I know I'll drive me crazy if I keep thinking about it, but I think I'll just keep thinking about it anyway because I just can't seem to stop. Her hand, her arm. They were bad. Worse than any traffic accident I ever saw. But what about all those other pieces? The severed heads, the eyes, the feet. Yes, sir, that must have been a wowser of a furnace explosion, all right."
"Where's our backup?"
Jingles asked restlessly.
"I don't know."
But when he saw them, he could really stump them, couldn't he?
"Got a riddle for you,"
he could say.
You'll never get it. How can you have mangled bodies all over the place after an explosion, but only one dead? And just by the way, how come the only real damage a furnace explosion did was to tear off the steeple of the town hall? For that matter, how come the head selectman, that guy Beringer, wasn't able to ID the body, when even I knew who it was? Give up, guys.
He had covered the arm with a blanket. There was nothing to be done about all the other body parts, and he supposed it didn't matter anyway. But he had covered Ruth's arm. On the sidewalk in Haven Village's town square, he had done that. He had done it while that idiot volunteer fire chief, Allison, stood grinning as if it was a bean supper instead of an explosion that had killed a fine woman. It was all crazy. Crazy to the max. Peter Gabbins was nicknamed Jingles because of his gravelly Andy Devine voice. Jingles was a character Devine had played in an old TV western series. When Gabbins came up from Georgia, Tug Ellender, the dispatcher, had started calling him that, and it had stuck. Now, speaking in a high, strangled voice, completely unlike his usual Jingles voice, Gabbins said, "Pull over, Ben, I'm sick." Rhodes pulled over in a hurry, on the very edge of a skid that almost dumped the cruiser in the ditch. At least Gabbins had been the first to call it. That was something. Jingles dove from the cruiser on the right, then Rhodes dove out on the left. In the blue strobe of the state police cruiser's lights, they both threw up everything available. Vent staggered back against the side of the car, pawing his mouth with one hand, hearing the retching noises still coming from the weeds beyond the edge of the road. He rolled his head skyward, dimly grateful for the breeze.
"That's better," Jingles said at last. "Thanks, Ben."
Benton turned toward his partner. Jingles' eyes were dark, shocked holes in his face. It was the look of a man who was processing all his information and reaching no sane conclusions at all.
"What happened back there?"
Ben asked.
"You blind hoss. Town hall steeple took off like a rocket."
"So how did a furnace explosion blow off the steeple?"
"Dunno."
"Spit on that."
Bent tried to spit. He couldn't.
"You believe it? A July furnace explosion that blows the steeple off the town hall?" "No. It stinks." "Right, Pard. It stinks to high heaven."
Bent paused.
"Jingles, what did you feel? Did you feel anything weird back there?"
Jingles said cautiously,
"Maybe. Maybe I did feel something."
"What?"
"I don't know,"
Jingles said. His voice had begun to climb, to take on the uneven, warbling inflections of a small child near tears. Above them, a galaxy of stars shone down. Crickets sang in fragrant summer silence.
"I'm just so damn glad to be out of there."
Then Jingles, who knew he would be going back to Haven the next day to assist in the cleanup and investigation, did begin to cry. 2. After a while, they drove on. Any remaining trace of daylight had by then left the sky. Bent was glad. He didn't really want to look at Jingles, and didn't really want Jingles looking at him.
"By the way, Bent,"
his mind now spoke up,
"it was pretty goddamn startling, wasn't it? Pretty goddamn weird. The severed heads and the legs with the little shoes still on, most of the little feet, and the torsos. Did you see the torsos? The eye, that one blue eye, did you see that? Must have. You kicked it into the gutter when you bent over to pick up Ruth McCausland's arm. All those severed arms and legs and heads and torsos. But Ruth was the only person who died. It's a riddle for a champagne riddle contest, all right."
The body parts had been bad. The shredded remains of the bats, an almighty lot of them, had also been bad. But neither had been as bad as Ruth's arm with her husband's ring on the third finger of the right hand, because Ruth's hand and arm had been real. The severed heads and legs and torsos had given him a hell of a shock at first. For a numb instant he had wondered, summer vacation or not, if a class had been touring the town hall when it blew. Then his numbed mind realized that not even kindergarten kids possessed limbs so small, and that no children possessed arms and legs which did not bleed when they were ripped from their bodies. He had looked around and seen Jingles holding a small smoking head in one hand, and a partially melted leg in another.
"Dolls,"
Jingles had said.
"Fucking dolls. Where did all the fucking dolls come from, Bent?"
He had been about to answer, to say he didn't know, although even then something about those dolls had tugged at him. It would come to him in time. When he noticed that there were people still eating in the Haven lunch, people still shopping in the market, a deep chill had touched his heart like a finger made of ice. This was a woman most of them had known all their lives, known, respected, and in many cases loved. But they were going on about their business. Going on about their business as if nothing at all had happened. That was when Bent Rhodes started wanting, seriously wanting, to be out of Haven. Now, turning down the radio that was still grinding out nothing but meaningless static, Bent remembered what had tugged at his mind earlier.
She had dolls. Mrs. McCausland.
Ruth,
Bent thought.
I wish I'd known her well enough to call her Ruth, like Monster does. Did. Everyone liked her, as far as I know. Which is why it seemed so wrong to see them just going about their business.
I guess I heard that, Jingle said. Hobby of hers, right? I guess I might have heard that at the Haven lunch. Or maybe at Cooter's having a pop with the old-timers.
A beer with the old-timers, more like it,
Rhodes thought, but he only nodded.
Yeah, and that's what they were, I reckon. Her dolls. I was talking about Mrs. McCausland one day last spring, I guess it was, with Monster, and... Monster?
Jingles asked.
Monster Dugan knew Mrs. McCausland. Pretty well, I guess. Monster and her husband were partners before her husband died. Anyway, he said she had 100 dolls, maybe 200. He said they were her only hobby, and they were exhibited once in Augusta. He said she was prouder of that exhibit than she was of any of the things she'd done for the town, and I guess she did a lot of things for Haven.
I wish I could have called her Ruth,
he thought again.
Monster said, except for her doll, she worked all the time.
Bent considered, then added,
the way Monster talked, I got an idea he was, sweet on her.
That sounded as old fucking fashioned as a Roy Rogers Western, but that was just how Butch, Monster, Dugan, had always seemed about Ruth McCausland.
Most likely you won't be the one get stuck breaking the news to him, but if you should, let me give you some advice. Don't crack wise. Yeah. Okay, duly noted. Monster Dugan on my case, that's all I'd need to round the day off, you know?
Bent smiled with no humor.
Her doll collection.
Jingles said. He nodded.
Of course, I knew they were dolls.
He saw Bent's wry glance and smiled a little.
Okay, I had a second or two there when... But soon as I saw the way the sun was shining on them, and how there was no blood, I knew what they were. Just couldn't figure out how come there was so many. You still don't know that. That or much else. We don't know what they were doing there. Hell, what was she doing there?
Jingles looked miserable.
Who would have killed her, Bent? She was such a nice lady. God damn.
I think she was murdered, Bent said. His voice sounded like breaking sticks in his ears.
Did it look like an accident to you? No. That wasn't no furnace explosion. And the fumes that kept us from going down in the basement. That smell like oil to you?
Bent shook his head. Whatever it was, he'd never before smelled anything like it in his life.
Maybe the only thing that Ned Berenger had been right about was his opinion that breathing those fumes could be dangerous, and it might be best to stay upstairs until the air in the town hall basement cleared. Now he had to wonder if they'd been kept away on purpose. Maybe so they wouldn't see a furnace that was completely unwounded.
"After we file our reports on this fucker,"
Jingle said,
"the local yokels are going to have a lot of explaining to do. Allison, Berenger, those guys. And they may have to do some of it to Dugan."
Bent nodded thoughtfully.
Whole fucking thing was crazy. The place felt crazy. I mean, I actually started to get dizzy. Did you? "The fumes,"
Jingles began doubtfully.
"Fuck the fumes. I was dizzy in the street." "Her dolls, Bent. What were her dolls doing there?"
"I don't know."
"Me either. But it's another thing that doesn't fit for shit. Try this on. If somebody hated her enough to murder her, maybe they hated her enough to blow her dolls up with her. You think?"
"Not really," Benton Rhodes said.
"But it could be,"
Jingle said, as if saying so proved it. Bent began to understand that Jingles was striving to create sanity out of insanity. He told Jingles to try the radio again. Their reception was a little better, but still nothing to write home about. Bent couldn't remember ever getting deep interference from the Troy microwave dish this close to Derry before. 3. According to the witnesses they spoke to, the explosion had occurred at 3:05 p.m., give or take half a minute. The town hall clock struck 3, as it always did. 5 minutes later, kabam! And now, riding back to Derry in the dark, an oddly persuasive picture occurred to Benton Rhodes, one that brought goose flesh to attention all over his body. He saw the clock in the town hall tower standing at 3:04 on that hot and windless late July afternoon, and suddenly, a look passes among those in the Haven Lunch, those in Cooter's General Store, those in Haven Hardware, the ladies in the Junkatorium, the children on the swings or hanging listlessly in the summer heat from the bars of the jungle gym in the play yard beside the school. It goes from the eyes of one of the overweight ladies playing doubles on the town tennis courts behind the town hall to her partner, and then to their overweight opponents on the other side of the net. The game ball goes rolling slowly into a far corner of the court as they lie down and put their hands over their ears and wait. As they wait for the explosion. Everyone in town lying down and waiting for that kablam to drill into the day like the stroke of a sledgehammer on thick wood. Bent suddenly shuddered behind the wheel of the cruiser.
The checkout girls at Cooter's. The customers in the aisles, the people in the Haven Lunch by the stools or behind the counter. At 3:04 p.m. they laid down, the whole fucking bunch of them, and at 3:06 they got up and went about their business. All of them except for the designated gawkers. Also Allison and Berenger, who told everybody it was a furnace explosion, which it wasn't, and that they didn't know who the victim was, which they fucking well did. You don't believe they all knew it was going to happen, do you?
A part of him believed just that. Because if the good folks of Haven hadn't known, how come the only casualties had been Ruth McCausland and her dolls? How come there hadn't been so much as a single cut arm when a shower of glass had flown across Main Street at a speed of roughly 110 miles an hour?
"I think we ought to be clear of that fucking dish by now," Bent said. "Try it again."
Jingles took the mic.
"I still don't understand where the goddamn backups are. Maybe something happened somewhere else. It never rains." "Yeah, it pours. Dolly arms and legs, among other things."
As Jingles depressed the mic button, Bent piloted the cruiser around a curve. The headlights and flashers splashed over a pickup truck that was slewed diagonally in the middle of the road.
"Jesus Christ!"
Then reflexes took over and he hit the brakes. Firestone rubber screamed and smoked. For a moment, Bent thought he was going to lose it. Then the cruiser came to a halt with its nose 3 yards from the body of the mongrel truck sitting silent in the road.
Please pass the toilet paper,
Jingle said in a low, trembling voice. They got out, both unstrapping the handles of their guns without thinking. The smell of cooked rubber hung in the summer air.
What's this shit?
Jingles cried, and Bent thought,
he feels it too. This isn't right. This is part of what was going on back in that creepy little town, and he feels it too.
The breeze stirred, and Bent heard canvas flap stiffly for a moment, and a tarp slid off something in the bed of the pickup with a dry rattlesnake sound. Bent felt his balls climb north in a hurry. It looked like the barrel of a bazooka. He started to crouch, then realized with bewilderment that the bazooka was only a length of corrugated culvert pipe in some sort of wooden cradle. Nothing to be afraid of. But he was afraid. He was terrified.
I saw that truck back in Haven, Bent, parked in front of the restaurant.
Who's there? Bent shouted. No answer. He looked at Jingles. Jingles, eyes wide and dark in his white face, looked back at him. Bent thought suddenly,
microwave interference? Was that really what was keeping us from getting through?
If someone's in that truck, you better speak up, Bent called.
A shrill, crazed titter came from the truck bed, then drifted into silence.
Oh, Christ, I don't like this,
Jingles Gabbins moaned. Bent started forward, raising his gun, and then the world was filled with green light. Chapter 5 Ruth McCausland 1 Ruth Arlene Merrill McCausland was 50, but looked 10 years younger, 15 on a good day. Everyone in Haven agreed that, woman or not, she was just about the best damned constable the town had ever had. It was because her husband had been a state trooper, some said. Others said it was simply because Ruth was Ruth. Either way, they agreed Haven was lucky to have her. She was firm, but fair. She was able to keep her wits in an emergency. Haven folks said these things about her, and more besides. In a small main town run by the men since there had been a town to run, such testimonials were of some note. That was fair enough. She was a noteworthy woman. She was born and raised in Haven. She was, in fact, the great-niece of the Reverend Mr. Donald Hartley, who had been so cruelly surprised by the town's vote to change its name back in '01. In 1955, she had been granted early admittance to the University of Maine, only the third female student in the history of the university to be granted full-time student status at the tender age of 17. She enrolled in the college's pre-law program. The following year she fell in love with Ralph McCausland, who was also in pre-law. He was tall. At 6'5", he was still 3 inches shorter than his friend Anthony Dugan, known as Butch by his friends, as Monster only by his two or three close friends. But he towered a full foot over Ruth. He was oddly, almost absurdly, graceful for such a big man, and good-natured. He wanted to be a state trooper. When Ruth asked him why, he said it was because his father had been one. He didn't need a law degree to join the fuzz, he explained to her. To become a state trooper, he needed only a high school education, good eyes, good reflexes, and a clean record. But Ralph McCausland had wanted something more than to do his father the honor of following in his footsteps.
Any man who gets into a job and doesn't plan a way to get ahead is either lazy or crazy,
he told Ruth one night over Coke's in the Bear's Den. What he didn't tell her, because he was shy about his ambition, was that he hoped to be Maine's top cop someday. Ruth knew anyway, of course. She accepted Ralph's proposal of marriage the following year on condition that he would wait until she had her own degree. She did not want to practice law, she said, but she did want to help him all she could. Ralph agreed. Any sane man confronted with Ruth Merrill's clear-eyed, intelligent beauty would have agreed. When Ralph married her in 1959, she was a lawyer. She came to their marriage bed a virgin. She had been a little worried about this, although only a deep part of her mind, a part over which even she could not exert her usual iron control, dared to wonder in a murky way if that part of him was as big as the rest of him.
It felt that way sometimes when they danced and petted. But he was gentle, and there was only a momentary discomfort that quickly turned to pleasure.
"Make me pregnant,"
she whispered in his ear as he began to move above her, in her.
"My pleasure, lady,"
Ralph said a little breathlessly. But Ruth never quickened. Ruth, the only child of John and Holly Merrill, had inherited a fairish sum of money and a fine old house in Haven Village when her father died in 1962. She and Ralph sold their small post-war tract home in Derry and moved back to Haven in 1963. And although neither of them would admit anything less than perfect happiness to the other, both were aware that there were too many empty rooms in the old Victorian house. Perhaps, Ruth sometimes thought, perfect happiness occurs only in a context of small discordancies, the shattering crash of an overturned vase or fishbowl, an exultant laughing yell just as you are drifting into a pleasant late afternoon doze, the child who gets pregnant with Halloween candy and who must perforce give birth to a nightmare in the early morning hours of November 1st. In her wistful moments, she saw to it that there were damned few of them, Ruth sometimes thought of the Mohammedan rug makers who always included a deliberate error in their work to honor the perfect deity who had made them, more fallible creatures. It occurred to her more than once that in the tapestry of an honestly lived life, a child guaranteed such a respectful error. But for the most part, they were happy. They prepared Ralph's most difficult cases together, and his court testimony was always quiet, respectful, and devastating. It mattered little if you were a drunk driver, an arsonist, or a fellow who'd broken a beer bottle over another fellow's head in a drunken roadhouse argument. If you were arrested by Ralph McCausland, your chances of beating the rap were roughly the chances of a guy standing at ground zero of a nuclear test site receiving only minor flesh wounds. During the years when Ralph was making his slow but steady climb up the ladder of the Maine State Police bureaucracy, Ruth began her career of town service. Not that she ever thought of it as a career, and certainly she never thought of it in the context of politics. Not town politics, but town service. That was a small but crucial difference. She was not as calmly happy about her work as she seemed to the people she was working for. It would have taken a child to completely fulfill her. There was nothing surprising or demeaning in this. She was, after all, a child of her own time, and even the very intelligent are not immune to a steady barrage of propaganda. She and Ralph had been to a doctor in Boston, and after extensive tests, he assured them that they were both fertile. His advice was for them to relax. In a way, this was cruel news. If one of them had proved to be sterile, they would have adopted. As it was, they decided to wait a while and take the doctor's advice, or try. And although neither knew or even intuited it, Ralph didn't have long to live by the time they had begun to discuss adoption again. End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.